Hello, friends. This is the AlphaList podcast. I am your host, Toby. The goal of the AlphaList podcast is to empower CTOs with the info and insight they need to make the best decisions for their company. We do this by hosting top thought leaders and picking their brains for insights into technical leadership and tech trends. If you believe in the power of accumulated knowledge to accelerate growth, make sure to subscribe to this podcast. Plus, if you're an experienced CTO, you will love the discussion happening in our Slack space where over 600 CTOs are sharing insights, or visit one of our events. Just go to alphaList.com to apply. In the red ocean of company podcasts, one has recently caught my attention. It's the Code-Centric Culture and Career Podcast. But before we dive in, a heads up. This podcast is in German. What sets this podcast apart? It's not the typical corporate noise we've all grown accustomed to. The folks at Code-Centrics are doing things differently. Instead of being drowned in promotional jungles, the employees themselves get a voice, sharing honest, unfiltered insights into their day-to-day lives in IT consulting. From fun and profit of project business to the struggles with imposter syndrome, right through to the challenges and rewards of parental leave in the consulting world. But what I truly appreciate about Code-Centrics' approach is their commitment to authenticity. Authentic communication is the heart of what they do. They are not there to put on a show or bombard listeners with ads. They are laying their culture out in the open, unafraid to discuss both their strengths and areas of growth. For those who value true stories and insights, the Code-Centric Culture and Career Podcast is not just another recommendation. It's a must listen. Give it a try and spend an hour listening. It's worth it. Just use Spotify or your usual podcast platform and search it, or go to link.alphaList.com/cc to do so. Welcome to the AlphaList podcast. I'm your host, Toby, and my guest today is Luca Rossi. And Luca is the founder of Refactoring Club, or Refactoring FM, a newsletter with over 50,000 subscribers, mostly addressing technical leaders and CTOs. And it's a newsletter about writing good software and working well with humans. And you've written like many, many articles, and they are like highly valuable. You even have like a paid subscription. You run a community. Like, you do many things. But beforehand, you acted as CTO. And today I want to know, like, why does a CTO turn a writer? And I guess then, like, writing is somehow maybe your superpower, and maybe you can give us more insights on how you use it, how you stay productive, and why every CTO should maybe turn into a writer every once in a while.
Absolutely. You made a great point. Yeah. First of all, thank you so much, Tobias, for having me. Fan of this podcast, so I'm really happy to have this chat. And thank you for the kind intro, and definitely happy to talk more about refactoring, what I do, why a CTO should turn into a writer, and maybe why all CTOs should be, you know, not full-time writers, but some kind of a writers in the job too. Yeah.
I mean, if you look at Amazon, for example, there's this idea of really writing essays about stuff you want to do. Did that influence you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the better you do your job, probably, especially if you are in a leadership position, the more you find yourself writing things for others to understand, to consume, and the more you get skilled in that, the more you get effective at your job in a way. But it's not something that I would say that you understand, or that you are, at least for me, it was not something I was thinking intentionally about, that is getting better at writing, but it's something that I think in retrospect, in hindsight, helped me down the line becoming a full-time writer as I am today.
So you were influenced by firstly your CTO career, then got a better, like became a better writer, and then ended up being a writer full-time. Is that correct?
Yeah. Basically, my longest professional experience have been as CTO and founder of a startup, in a consumer startup in the travel space. We raised venture capital here in Italy. We eventually sold the company to a larger player in the space. Then I also got another job in the meantime, but I had already started writing this newsletter exactly inspired by my journey as a CTO, because my job as a CTO was my very first job out of PhD. I didn't know how to do anything, and it was especially hard for me to find valuable and relevant material about, not much, I would say, software development, but rather how to lead a team, how to grow a startup team. So I started writing the things that I would have loved to know and to learn when I was younger. So thinking about managers, CTOs, and engineers in high growth startups who want to level up their teams. The newsletter started as a side gig, but it grew very fast to more than 10,000 subscribers during the first year. And so at the end of the first year, I thought, okay, let's try to put my founder hat again, and let's try to do this full time, because fortunately I had already the example of other great newsletters who had made the leap thanks to Substack and thanks to the better and better tools that were available already at that time. And turned out to be good, because fast forward today, as you said, more than 50,000 subscribers, 1,400 paid. So really happy so far.
Okay. One of my questions would be like, can you still stay ahead of the game in your tech skills if you're mostly writing?
That's a great question. This was one of my biggest concerns, honestly, when I started doing this all the time. Of course, I would be lying if I said that I'm still as, you know, sharp and on the razor's edge when it comes to tech chops, for example, as when I was a CTO of, you know, tens of people. So I don't get to lead, you know, complex software projects as I did before. But I like to think that I compensate by having many conversations with other tech leaders, telling their stories, telling real world experience. And so if I've lost something on a practical side, I feel much more prepared on many other things. So I would say, you know, the balance is, the upsides are more than the downsides so far.
It's also, I don't do the podcast as a full-time gig and Alphalist as a full-time gig, but it's also like partly why I do it. Like having conversations with other leaders and learning from them and getting inspired is even more important than being the best, I don't know, Ruby developer or something.
Absolutely. And I think I realized this very late, because when I was a CTO, I admit I didn't invest, I think, enough time in having good conversation with peers. I think it was not easy on one side, because in Italy, the tech ecosystem is not very big. So it's not easy to get these conversations reliably. But of course, I could have done more and better, because I now see the gains. You know, if I was a CTO still and I was having these kind of conversations, there were so many things, so many takeaways that I could take literally and apply to my job.
Okay. Maybe we step back a little. I want to know from my, like, each of my guests, like, how did they get into the computing game? Why did they turn into a nerd initially? Can you tell me?
Of course. I mean, I had the computer from very early age. My father brought it home. I think I was like 6 or 7 years old. Of course, I didn't start programming. I was mostly playing games. But I did start programming on my own when I was in high school, but I didn't even know it was programming. You know, I did a lot of things with computers back in the days, you know, creating some small websites, playing competitive games, programming some games. But I had no idea this could turn into a career, honestly. So even when I was finishing high school, didn't know that computer science was even a thing, you know. But then some friends of mine joined computer science and I followed them. And from there, I got in love with all the this whole space. And I still am. And after the university, I started a PhD in computer science and mostly databases. But then I quit. I dropped out after about 1 year because I had founded also my startup with a couple of friends. So like in the stories, you know, I'm a PhD dropout and I started a startup as my very first job, literally.
Okay. Interesting. And then you founded like Wonder.io, it was called, right?
Yes.
And brought it from zero to 25 million customers, right?
Yes, quite a lot. Mostly in Italy.
Quite a lot.
Yeah, it was quite a lot. Yeah, it was an incredible journey. We loved every, I can say we loved every minute of it because of course it's been a roller coaster. There were highs and lows. But we are incredibly proud to have become so popular in our country, especially because Italy and our domestic market has always been the vast majority of our customers. And so, yeah, the app and the website let people compare and book multiple modes of transport. So if you had to go from A to B in a nutshell, instead of going to the, you know, flights websites like Skyscanner, trains and buses on separate websites, you could do everything on a single website, Wonder.io, and book everything in one place. So that was the core value proposition, to save people time, basically.
Okay. So I could hear that like Italy most likely has similar problems to Germany, where like the domestic market is big enough to kind of grow to a certain level and feed a team. And many companies, I guess, in Italy also don't internationalize, but rather focus on domestic market. Is that correct?
That is correct. And in our case, there was also, I would say, another problem that the problem and the pain that we solved was especially perceived in Italy, as opposed, for example, to the US. So when we spoke to US VCs, they told us, we don't really have this problem in the US. We basically don't have trains, don't have many buses. So people don't have much choice when it comes to getting somewhere. Mm. So this is really a European problem. So we launched it to Spain. I mean, there are countries that are similar to Italy and we internationalized a bit. But then, I mean, things, we got acquired. So we are happy with how it ended anyway.
Okay. Yeah, in Italy, travel is also special because Italians mostly travel to Italy, right? So,
yeah, they traveled inside Italy a lot.
Yeah,
and there are so many ways to get in anywhere because the county has this weird shape. You know, we have many trains, many buses to go everywhere. So it's really not trivial to figure out how to go from A to B in many, many cases.
So coming back to writing and the role of the CTO, what are your thoughts on the role of the CTO in the next years? Will it change in many aspects, or will it stay the same? What are your thoughts about it?
I think for once, I mean, like all leadership and very, very high level roles, it really depends on the size, the scale and the stage of your company and your product. So, of course, it's hard to, you know, to speak for every CTOs, whether they are from big tech or, you know, small startups. But in general, I think we are in a time of such a big transformation with AI and workflows can become really different from what they are today. There are many opportunities. So probably more now than ever, it pays off to stay on top of trends and figure out how to apply new ideas and and workflows to your team. I think one of the mistakes that I did as a CTO sometimes was staying too much in the trenches. And, you know, at some point you see the trees and you don't see the forest anymore. And it's really beneficial to step back sometimes and not to overwhelm yourself so that you stay sharp and understand what's the best way of doing something, because it doesn't really matter to get that 10% better when you miss that 10x opportunity, you know?
Absolutely. From my perspective, it's also much about understanding the business needs and requirements, yeah, and not putting in too much time into refactoring. Yes. If you don't need to, right? Yes.
Absolutely.
As an example, I mean, a CTO who starts at a company and the first thing he says is, yes, I want to rewrite everything.
I need a full rewrite.
It happens all the time, like most of the time, I would say.
Yes.
But it's not the best sign from my perspective. At
no,
least.
Absolutely. And I think that also sometimes it's a sign of CTOs who are very, for example, specialized into something, into some technology, into some way of doing things. And so when you have a hammer and everything looks like a nail, you know, you know how to do things all in a way. And you can apply this not just to technology, you know, you can apply this to managers who say, okay, we don't have to do presentations anymore. We only have to do this, or vice versa. You know, they try to apply very in a prescriptive way what they're used to do, or what they want to do. While instead, I think, especially with established products, it always pays off to take the best out of what you have. You know, like in football teams, you have to adapt to the players you have in the team rather than, you know, force things your way.
We all know how hard it is to attract top tech talent. But what if I told you there's a recruiting platform that's already helping over 600 companies, including HelloFresh, Amazon, and MyPoster, to hire tech talent in less than 25 days. It is called Instafo, and as an AlphaList listener, you get to enjoy the Instafo recruiting platform absolutely free until you find the perfect hire. Intrigued? Hit pause and check it out right now at instafo.com/CTO. By leveraging sophisticated matchmaking and allowing you to chat directly with pre-qualified tech talent right on the platform, they've made the hiring process 3 times more efficient, from matched to hired in one go. Whilst classic job portals, in-house active sourcing, and headhunters give you the headache of paying upfront, having high setup efforts, and dealing with 30% hiring fees, with Instafo, this is now history for you. As an AlphaList listener, you only pay when you make a successful hire and save hours of recruiting work per week. At Instafo, over 2,000 tech talents and companies are connected every week. So what are you waiting for? Go to instafo.com/CTO. That is instafo.com/CTO to get started.
I think it's often in the nature of human to simplify things to their space of understanding and needs, right? I also see like a slight trend to CTOs becoming more like generalists, and CEOs maybe becoming more like specialists, and like CPOs maybe also entering the game, and then like us ending in a mix with a slight specialization maybe at a certain point.
Yes.
What do you think about that?
I think it's as a CTO you definitely have to be a generalist in some fashion, because it's not like you have to master or, you know, all the pieces of your stack or the pieces of your product, but it's really important that enough to know what's good, you know, what good looks like, so that you can evaluate what you're doing. You can follow your people and evaluate how they're doing. You can hire with confidence. So that really doesn't mean you have to be the most proficient guy at writing, some code, but you have to know what good looks like at the various parts of your tech. That's what I think. So I mean, if your CTO is not a generalist, who should be, you know, even in your team? That's the peak generalist role, I would say.
Mm-hmm. There, the good old imposter syndrome enters the room. Like, when do you actually know enough? Do you need to be an expert or just curious? I think you already answered, but
I think you definitely don't need to be an expert, but it's a tricky question because I think the part of your job that is more art, you know, that science, is figuring out exactly how much you should know and how much it's okay that you don't know. That depends on so many things. You know, of course, when your team is small, you're probably coding all the time anyway. So you have to be more of an expert, and the more core, hardcore generalist nature of your role comes out when your team is bigger. So you have to figure out how much you can let go at any given time, how much you can not know as opposed to what you should keep your hold on. And that's hard.
Absolutely. How do you keep yourself fed with stuff you wanna know? Do you read books, or like, do you surf the web, or do you just write your newsletter and then like all of a sudden you know enough? Or
no, I mean, it's hard for me. It's hard for me too, especially because, you know, now I don't have. I mean, as long as you have a team and a product, it's not that hard to figure out what you should know, you know. But once you have a newsletter, when in theory, it's not a technical job anymore. So it's not like you need to be technical. It's even harder to say, I want to learn this. I want to know more about that. So I follow my curiosity. Basically, I have my side projects and toy projects, trying some text, trying AI, what feels interesting to me. But of course, one thing is to, you know, have your pet project where you try things for fun. Another thing is to try with a fully fledged team. So I wouldn't give myself a high score on that anyway.
Okay. And do you have like a, I don't know, a huge block role or something to keep yourself, your brain fed with trends, or like, how does it work for you?
Yeah, I consume most of my content via probably other newsletters and stuff that comes to my email. I have a complicated relationship with nonfiction books. Really, I usually don't like them. I feel they're very diluted, not the best medium to learn about, especially tech stuff. They're linear. They don't fit the way I learn typically. But I like newsletters, and one of the reasons why I started one is that I was already a big fan of newsletters. So yes, I try to stay up to date with by subscribing to feeds of content that are the most relevant and the most interesting to me, and not just newsletters. I get digests, you know, of other outlets, digests of Hacker News, of Product Hunt, or of more techie things. And I take a lot of notes. I mean, I send everything to my, you know, note-taking pipeline, and my notes are really the backbone then of my writing. Because when I have enough notes and enough ideas to write about something, then I start writing an article that should go out in the newsletter.
Note-taking pipeline really sounds complicated, as if you have like a Kafka stream you feed your stuff into. And
no, it's really, I mean, I realized it felt complicated the moment that I said this, and I thought, why I said no taking Python? but it's really very simple. I use an app called Readwise, which is very, very useful. It works both as a read later app and then as a highlighting app that sends highlights to Notion in my case, but it can send highlights to any destination you like, basically, so that I have my, let's say, repository of notes and highlights of content that I liked. And I take that as an inspiration for writing new articles, combined, of course, with my own pre-existing ideas and experience.
And that you do in Notion?
Yes, I do it in Notion, and then I pass it on Substack when it's time to publish.
Okay. And how much time do you spend on writing?
It's about half of my day when you combine writing and research. So because sometimes, you know, it's hard to separate the one from the other. It's usually the mornings. So the mornings are for writing, where I am at peak of my energy, because writing is very, very cognitively intensive. I mean, I get completely burned out after some hours of writing. And so I schedule writing time at the moment of the day where I'm the most productive, which for me is the morning. And I keep the afternoon for other, you know, MISC work or product work, let's say, and on other parts of the newsletter or the community, or recording a podcast, like in this case. So the stuff that is not writing.
And do you have like a fully structured day apart from that? Like, do you have lots of meetings, etc.? Or like, is it just like creating and reading? And
no, it's pretty structured. It's pretty structured because the mornings are or they're organized in slots for writing and for research and so on. And also, the afternoons have slots for stuff that I have to do on a recurring basis, like. It can be planning the social media posts. It can be creating some, working on some of the community ceremonies for running the community, or for reviewing work that has to be done, or for talking with sponsors, planning future interviews. So I'm a creature of habit, and I try to create slots for pretty much everything that I want to do on a regular basis.
Mm. And how did you find your unique angle and voice? So what makes your take on a situation unique?
That's a very hard question. And this is also something I was very concerned about. That is, will I write about relevant things? Will I write about things that are interesting? And what value do I bring to the table when I write about something? But I think over time, you just figure out that if you speak honestly from a place of curiosity, and you stay open to ideas, you almost always find an interesting angle, or you write things that are interesting to read. I mean, at the end, you have to trust your taste. You have to trust that when you believe that something is interesting, because you would be the first who would be interested to read about it, then there would be other people who will find it interesting as well. So it's not useful to ask yourself that question too hard. You don't have to be too hard on yourself, I think, on that.
So essentially, you measure your newsletter growth, and that's the biggest evidence for you having a voice, right?
I mean, you could say that, yeah, in a way, yes. But I also want to make sure that I keep writing things that I would like to write to read myself. Which you might think it's the same thing, but it's not really, because I may end up, you know, writing about things in a superficial way, or in a way that doesn't really get to the core of things, and still find an audience. But if I was not doing something that I like myself, then I wouldn't be able to do this very well, I think.
That makes sense. Absolutely makes sense. When it comes to productivity, I mean, you seem to be like a bit of a productivity nerd. I think you also published a lot on productivity. Do you have a framework, a system to kind of keep yourself productive? I think, yeah, like as a lone fighter, it's like kind of not always easy, right?
Absolutely. I think this was one of the biggest, you know, discoveries of going solo like that. Is that it's way harder from some points of view to stay productive and manage your own productivity, because something that many engineers tell you is that if I had not, you know, all these people around me making me waste my time, all these meetings and stuff, I would be super productive if I was just by myself working on my projects, etc. But that's just one side of the coin, you know, because the other side is that when you're in a team, you have a train of things happening that carry you, even in the bad days, even when you are low energy. So you have to do things, you are accountable to other people. And so you do things even without thinking that much. But when you get up in the morning and you are only by yourself, and if you did not work that morning, nothing spectacularly bad happened, then there is like a hidden friction, additional friction to do anything, you know. So I think it's not an easy path, and you get to learn a lot about yourself. In my case, what works very well is, as I told you, time boxing everything, and you know, and putting everything on my calendar, and then trusting my calendar pretty much blindly. And also working in small sessions. So I work in Pomodoros, like 30-minute sessions, followed by small pauses. And because otherwise, if I get too much into what I'm doing for too many hours, I mean, I get tunnel vision, my energy drops, I can't really work all day. So it's a combination of time boxing, small sessions for recovery, and then other things. I mean, prioritizing your work, of course, trying to match the importance and the how hard is something you have to do with the times that you are more rested, you have more energy, and so being smart about when you do things.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the 30-hour sessions. Like what happens if you absolutely end up in this state of flow for a bigger task? And you have your 30 minutes, like, do you stay in your system? Do you force yourself to drop out? Or
I mean, I can like forego the rule for like two sessions and like work to 1 hour consecutively. I mean, I'm not gonna lie, sometimes may happen, but what I found is that if I work too much, too long without pauses, so on things where I am in a state of flow, then I'm tricking myself. I mean, I think I am productive when I'm really not that much. I think the whole idea of the state of flow is a bit flawed, or at least it's not like people think. Because when you work, you know, you hear people say, I've been working like 2 hours and a half on coding in a state of flow. I mean, at some point you're not, I think you're not effective. It's like when it happened to everybody, you know, when you're debugging something, you spend 2 hours on a bug, and then you leave work, you come the morning after and you fix it in 5 minutes. No, and because at some point you don't have energy, but you do not realize that because you are too much into work. So I try to force myself to break, to take breaks. Yeah.
And when you use time boxing, like you use your calendar, and like someone who forces you to also stop, or like do you have people around you, or do you just like feel you work
no.
on your own, or?
You see how hard it is. I mean, I don't have anyone around.
Yeah.
So it's whatever I want to do, you know, if I want to do sessions, or I want to limit the amount of work I do on something, I mean, it's all about myself, also about my discipline. And so that's the hard part. But yes, I use my calendar. I use it to do app. I use Todoist. And then I put the tasks on Todoist on my calendar. I use an app for that. It's called Akiflow. It's very good. And which also surfaces things from Notion, from other sources. So the final goal is to have everything on your calendar, mm-hmm. really. The calendar is like the source of truth. And then you have to kind of trust it blindly, saying, this is how much time I decided to spend on this. Maybe it's better to stop working on that and switch into the other thing rather than having all the day, you know, sleep because I decided to work double the time on that. Mm-hmm.
Tired of sifting through countless resumes and struggling to find the right tech talent? Look no further. WorkGenius has some exciting news to share with you. WorkGenius has acquired ExpertLead. Now, they bring even more efficiency to your hiring process. Real-time live coding assessments for all. Whether you're a startup or an established enterprise, WorkGenius is now also here to turbocharge your hiring process. Say goodbye to the guesswork and endless interviews. WorkGenius matches your candidates with experts, saving you time and getting you top talent. Win-win. How it works? Share your tech job applicants, WorkGenius takes care of the rest. Your candidates? They are in the hands of seasoned pros. WorkGenius matches them with experienced senior developers and puts them through tailored, enjoyable, and fair technical interviews. Your company gets the cream of the crop, the most sought-after talents in the industry, and you save your hardworking tech and HR teams valuable time. If you want to try it out, visit link.alphalist.com/work.
I use an app called Reclaim AI. I don't know if you know it. It also is a similar idea you kind of fully trust the app, and then it organizes your one-on-ones and also pushes in your tasks. But I wasn't sure about me putting tasks in there. I still have in a separate system, and I'm sometimes like thinking about doing it, but my calendar is already like wasted. I don't have enough time to actually do real tasks every once in a while, but just have like too many meetings. Maybe that would change it, right?
Yeah, it's. I totally get it. I mean, about the first thing you said, that you do not totally trust it to contain your tasks. What sold it to me, what made Akiflow work for me, for example, is that the source of truth of tasks stayed Todoist, which was what I was already using. And the app only surfaced the tasks from the other database, let's say, and put it on the calendar. So that was what made it work for me. But when it comes instead to what you said, that you have interruptions, other things going on, meetings that are impromptu, etc., I totally understand. I mean, I was not this disciplined when I was a CTO. Mm. And I think it's good in principle, and I think you should strive to time box things and put them in your calendar, even if you have a leadership job in a team, etc. But you also have to know that you have interruptions, you have to stay responsive to people who need you. So you can't really, put yourself in a rut and just do your thing. It's not what your job is about. But you can try to minimize interruptions and unforeseen things, of course.
I sometimes struggle with the concept of having dedicated dates for recurring times for one-on-ones. Because for me, like, I sometimes have the feeling, okay, it turns into like a regular thing where you just do it without questioning it. And that's always bad. Yeah. Like, recurring meetings are, from my perspective, really like harmful. And then having that set every second week, let's say, and then, it turns like, can turn into a therapy session from my perspective. I don't know if that's actually good.
I mean, one-on-ones are, of course, incredibly important meetings, and you have this risk that since you do this frequently, you do this weekly or every other week, things turn into just routine, and people, both your rapport and yourself, enter the meeting, a bit of a mindless wave. You just follow the flow. But the thing is, of course, we should really strive to be instead very present, ask questions if the conversation kind of stagnates, having some fallback points. I mean, I've learned from the best managers I had that to do good one-on-ones, you need to prepare, which is something I did not do for many years. And I'm honest about that. You have to prepare. It's one of the things where you have to be high energy, which surprises some people who think, no, one-on-ones are kind of my relaxing time. Well, maybe it shouldn't. It's one of the hardest things to pull off well, I think, as a manager.
But it's also the realization, okay, I have too many one-on-ones. I have too many reports, maybe at a certain point. You're too floated with different things so that you can't really focus on the things anymore. I think that's what many people are struggling with, right? And not saying no.
Absolutely. I think then it's you do double damage because when you have too many variables and one once, because on one side you have less time for your other things, of course. But then also the one-on-ones themselves, maybe you have the physical time to schedule them on the calendar, but then you don't have the time to follow up on the items that come up in conversation because you have too many reports, too many of them. And so what happens is that over time, people just don't trust that you can solve their problems when they bring them in conversation. And so they stop bringing them up in one-on-ones. One-on-ones become less and less useful. So it's a vicious cycle in a way. Mm-hmm. So I don't think you can really have too many reports. You have to make sure that you not only have the conversations, but can also, you also have the time to act on those things.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That leads me to one question block I have for you still. Like, if you would build a school for CTOs, what would be the curriculum? Would that be one of the things you would teach, like proper one-on-ones, or what else would you from your conversations and from your writing time?
This is a great question. I think one of the things that is really useful for people to go through is working in a company that grows through different growth stages, headcount that grows. You know, when you are a CTO in a team that starts small, you know, maybe all generalists or something, and then you grow. And then you have to organize teams in a different way. Communication changes because it breaks the way it used to be. So living these changes is really what makes you understand the first principles behind why you should do things in a way or another. So in a school for CTO, I would probably role play, you know, many situations of actual work. Where you have to figure out how to make collaboration happen, how to stay, some of the things we said before, staying the right amount of technical without being, you know, too much hands-on and bottlenecking your team's growth, but also understanding what's going on. And then, of course, it pretty much depends on your product, on your company. Like all founders and all C-levels, your work pretty much changes based on the people around you. I mean, I've seen CTOs who are a lot into product, for example, because the CEO was not a lot into product or there was not a strong product person around, or vice versa. You know, CTOs who were a lot into marketing because maybe CEO, it's a big deal for that company, stuff like that. So you have to be open at becoming what your company and your product needs you to be, basically. Mm.
And jump into it, like take different roles at a certain point, ideally, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And that changes all the time. Exactly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, one of the most useful things that I learned from an investor of mine is to think at your job as a founder specifically, but I think as a CTO, it works the same. Like a game where you have to replace yourself continuously. That is, you figure out how to do something well, figure out what good looks like, and then figure out how to not do that yourself, how to hire somebody to do that or make somebody in the team to do that, because it also forces you to structure how that thing should be done by others, not just by yourself. Mm-hmm. So replacing yourself continuously.
Mm-hmm. 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 I also went through that learning journey. absolutely right. If you had, like, apart from that, like three concrete tips that you could give to, like, hand over to our listeners from your conversations and your recent writings, like what would it be? Like, can be productivity, can be a tool, can be something, like just three things.
Let me think about this. I'll try to mention things from different areas, you know, to make it more useful for more people. For example, one theme that always comes up in an email, in follow-up questions, conversations is how much data-driven, how many metrics you should use in your engineering team. But because you mentioned productivity, so there is all this engineering productivity and
developer productivity. Yes.
Yes.
Good topic.
It's a, yes, big fight, you know.
Yeah.
And I think people can start being data-driven and more aware of what happens around them just having good conversations with people. So make sure before you jump into, you know, whatever tool or trend you see, that you know, you have a grasp of how people are happy with things around them. I mean, are they happy about their CI/CD or about how code reviews happen? It's not that they should be happy, but yet you know how happy they are for 1 to 10, you know, at this level of granularity. I mean, if you don't know this already because you speak with people, then you don't have to, you have to figure out that before you integrate the tool. It's not
before
the
you
tool
do Dora metrics. Yes.
Yes. Before you get into the Dora metrics, you know, yeah. that is something on top, something more that is helpful, but
yeah.
given that you have the basic figured
right.
out.
Well, so, but also if you think about it, like really hard to integrate. And recently I had AB Noda here on the podcast, like the guy who's building getdx.com. I found it really convincing. I mean, it's the same angle, right? Like talk to people, listen to people, do a survey. Yeah. And
do a survey.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
do a survey.
People are skeptical because many say, but it's stupid to do a survey for the scene. No, it's not stupid. I mean, you can get this data very simply. I mean, it doesn't have to be quantitative in a way that is, you know, a number with digits. You know, you don't need that. You need the scale for 1 to 5
yeah.
for most things
yeah.
just to understand the,
yeah.
But I'm not, this is not to discount metrics, of course. Metrics are useful, very useful when used for good, you know, of course. But sometimes people jump, you know, jump the trend and think that they're the one thing that solves their problems as opposed to, you know, just having good conversations again.
Also, it's very appealing for technical leaders, right? Like you just plug into this tool into Git and then you get a list
it's
of
done.
Like, yeah, you know how productive your people are. But also like developer productivity is a bad term, right? Like for the people that are being spied, let's say,
yes.
that might feel not correct. And that's
yeah.
why I like the approach with surveys better.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, of course, you can build from there. You can integrate these tools. And these are very useful. I mean, I want to be clear on that.
Mm-hmm.
But they're useful when you don't... I don't think you should see these numbers as things that are targets you have to achieve. You know the, how they say that a good measure becomes a bad measure once you put a target on that, right? So when I think of the best uses that I've seen talking with people of engineering metrics, they're always to start conversations, you know, to figure out why something is happening and to back, you know, some talks that you want to have or to back initiatives. So you look at numbers and talk with people from a place of curiosity and figure out why we are taking so much time to do code reviews. What is the bottleneck? How can I make it better for you? Why we are spending, I don't know, if you measure your engineering investment, you know, between technical debt, new features. I mean, are we happy with that? Are we spending, do we feel we are spending too much time on technical debt and we can repay that? For those things, having these tools, it's perfect. It backs conversations with stakeholders. You know, it's good to have something to point and say, see, we are spending 50% of our time on technical debt. Maybe, you know, you should do something about that. But when you don't use this for this reason and you set a target for things and you measure people's performance with these things, then people feel that you're tracking them, then it's not the right use.
Mm-hmm. So we spend now lots of time on the first tip that you had? Yeah. What other two do you have? Just quick ones.
I agree. So another tip that I have, and this is inspired from a conversation with also Kaz Nejatian from Shopify, the CEO of Shopify, is to think at, even if you're a manager, you should, it's good to think at yourself as a maker of not just, you know, not systems, technical systems anymore, but people systems. So you can still be a maker of, you know, good processes, ways to simplify people work. So it's not like if you're a manager, you should spend all of your time in meetings. Okay, that's a sign that something is failing, and you're a maker that should fix that. Your engineers should fix the code, and you should fix how people work. So that was a very interesting angle that I took it with me, and I tell it to people sometimes.
Well, the last one.
The last one should definitely be to write more. And when I say write, I don't only mean write in your, you know, within your team or your company. I mean writing in public. Doesn't have to be, you know, a weekly newsletter, something that is very high effort or whatever, even if it's a small blog, even if you publish infrequently. But writing things down on the internet creates such a great flywheel for everything. Clears up your mind about your opinions, about many things. You get feedback. You get to know, you know, like-minded people who think like you on many things. Writing online is really like networking for introverts. You don't have to reach out to people. It's other people who reach out to you. It's insane. So even when you think you don't have a lot to say, it's never true. Mm. It's just that your mind is not used to think that you can write your own ideas. But when you start thinking about ideas you can write and you do it this, you know, regularly, you will always find something to write, and it would be great investment for your personal growth, for your career, for everything.
Thanks a lot, Luca. That brings me to my last and popular outro question. I have a little surprise. So from your very early days as a newsletter publisher, I was actually one of your first paid subscribers. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I know. And I actually got a tip from your newsletter, which is like a deep meditation technique that actually helps you to physically travel in time. If you focus enough. And I know that you're practicing it a lot. You're then like able to manipulate and optimize who you are today and make the better version of yourself. And we now like both close our eyes, like please close your eyes. And we can now travel back in time when you were working at Wonder.io in 2012 and you just like dropped out of university. And we're observing yourself for a while, like you're spending way too much time on solving technical problems, as we know. Yes. And you now have the chance to whisper something into young Luca's ears. What would it be?
That's one of the, you know, those emotional questions also. I think one thing I would whisper is probably, it will be okay. You will be good at this, and you will go together with the team. It will be enough. What you will do will be enough. And this is something many founders, I think, need to hear. You can do this. It will be okay, whatever happens. And then I would probably tell him to always talk with people. It doesn't matter, you know, frameworks, one-on-ones, stuff, but always nurturing the team, as opposed to, you know, sometimes you put your headphones, head down coding, which is just the most convenient and comfortable thing to do.
Okay, thanks a lot. Learned a lot today. So like really different angle, right? I know that I like ideally would also spend more time on writing. Hope to see you soon, maybe in person in Italy or somewhere. Maybe we have the chance. Was lots of fun.
Thank you so much, Tobias, for having me. It was a great chat, and for sure, if I ever come to Germany or if you come to Rome, happy to catch up.
Have a great day. Bye.
Have a good day. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the AlphaList podcast. If you like this episode, share it with friends. I'm sure they love it too. Make sure to subscribe so you can hear deep insights into technical leadership and technology trends as they become available. Also, please tell us if there is a topic you would like to hear more about or a technical leader whose brain you would like us to pick. AlphaList is all about helping CTOs getting access to the insights they need to make the best decisions for their company. Please send us suggestions to cto@alphaList.com, send me a message on LinkedIn or Twitter. After all, the more knowledge we bring to CTOs, the more growth we see in tech. Or, as we say on AlphaList, accumulated knowledge to accelerate growth. See you in the next episode.